we're ready to go back in the record in the on this autism proceeding in the King and Mead cases. Counsel, anything we need to take care of before we get started? All right. All right, I see Dr. Deeth is back in the witness chair. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you.
You're still under oath.
I am.
From your previous time. So, Mr. Williams, please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, Dr. Deeth.
Good morning, Michael.
I'm going to try and run through several very specific criticisms that were made of your testimony and your work by the four different experts that the defense called to critique your work. First, Dr. Dean Jones talked about how much glutathione there is in the human body and how the amount of glutathione is so overwhelming compared to the amount of mercury that the thimerosal-containing vaccines would deliver, that it would simply be able to take care of it. What is your response to that critique?
Yes, I had the chance to review Dr. Jones's testimony and comments, and I certainly indicated my respect for the body of work that he's done and the facts that he's assembled here. The issue about how much glutathione there is in our bodies versus the amount of mercury that's delivered in thimerosal injections, for example, is a issue of stoichiometry. That is, the thimerosal mercury is not interacting stoichiometrically or one for one with the glutathione. And this was never a premise of, for example, the theory or the mechanisms that we put forth or that I put forth in my testimony. And moreover, the ability of mercury to remain in the body and to enter the brain, as has been verified in studies, Burbacher et al., and just many studies, shows that the vast amount, and there is a vast amount of glutathione available, is not able to overwhelm this mercury and make sure that it doesn't enter the body or enter the brain. It's there. And because it's there, it causes effects. Now, Dr. Jones seemed to be developing an argument or thought that because there's just so much more thimerosal quantitatively, that it would swamp out the mercury. And even though that's a simplistic thought,
I think you meant glutathione. You said thimerosal.
Excuse me. The glutathione would swamp out the mercury or the thimerosal, the target of the thimerosal or the inorganic mercury that it releases is not glutathione itself. There's a lot of that, but the targets, the proteins that it eventually binds to in the brain, inside of astrocytes and neurons and microglia, those targets and the amount of them, the proteins that are regulatory, those are in the small quantities. And so the really more valid question Dr. Jones didn't exactly raise himself was, what's the proportion of targets for mercury in the body that have the highest affinity for mercury, and what's the relative amount of them versus the amount of mercury? Is there enough mercury to saturate those targets and to bind to them? And these are protein targets. They're not glutathione.
Now, do the adult monkeys that we know were covered in the Charleston Burbacher studies back in the mid-90s, do those adult monkey brains have glutathione in them?
Surely they did. All cells of the body have 1 to 10 millimolar glutathione in them.
And yet the mercury, we know the mercury from those studies was able to provoke neuroinflammation in those monkey brains.
That's right. To the point that that I just made, that the provocation of the inflammatory response is not because there's so much mercury that it depletes the glutathione one for one. That's not it. It's because those critical regulatory mechanisms are built upon sulfur and thiols, binding the mercury, and it's their interaction that's causing the inflammation.
Now, he also said that because of the dietary intake of glutathione, and he gave an example of drinking apple juice would deplete glutathione and knock it down. Mm-hmm. What do you have to say in response to the apple juice example?
This would be a blow to the apple industry, of course, if we decided to equate drinking of apple juice with the ingestion of mercury. It's just obviously nonsensical on its face, but the transiency of the apple juice response, and quite frankly, I'm not a nutritionist, and I'm really not that familiar with what it does, but the idea that there are fluctuations in glutathione levels as a result of diet, what we take in has certain oxidative demands that it increases. So undoubtedly, there'll be shifts in the amount of glutathione measured in the blood in particular, because after ingestion, this is where the impact of what we just ate is felt, is in the bloodstream. Inside of cells, it's going to be less so. In other words, if you biopsy the liver after drinking apple juice, you probably wouldn't find the same fluctuations you find in the bloodstream, you know, for example. And I'll offer further that because the brain is behind the blood-brain barrier, protected as it is, it would be even less likely than peripheral tissues like liver to show fluctuations in response to diet. So those things can occur. They're an important part of nutritional status, but they're certainly a whole different realm than the effects of a prolonged agent like mercury, which if I ingest the apple juice at breakfast this morning, by now it would have disappeared. It would be metabolized. If I ingested mercury, I'll be buried with the mercury because it just doesn't change. It's always mercury. It's always there.
Now, either Dr. Jones or one of the other of the four experts also said that depressing glutathione actually provokes a protective response by the body. Mm-hmm. What's your response to that?
Yes, we're well aware of the adaptive responses that are inherent in the so-called redox system of the body. It's really very interesting. It's critical for life that you have the ability to adapt to stressors. And the adaptation can be very short-term. It can be moderate. It can be long-term. There's a whole series of adaptive responses. And they're all designed to bring the system back to homeostasis, this sort of classical word for like normal metabolism, normal function. And in fact, the redox system, in my opinion, is primary. I think it's the most important evolutionary factor that maintains homeostasis of all cells. So no doubt, when you shift it one way, you bounce back. And the reason you bounce back is because adaptive responses have been generated to help you bounce back. But some people don't bounce back. When you have a limitation in the system, perhaps in this case introduced by a burden of mercury, a persistent burden, your adaptive responses are trying to bring you back to normal, but you remain in a stressed state where the resources, sulfur resources, are in some cases desperately trying to bring back the glutathione levels to normal, but you're not able to do that. And it's really an inability of the individuals with autism, but other related oxidative stress disorders, the inability of them for their own reasons, partly genetic, that they're unable to bounce back and otherwise return to homeostatically normal conditions, that leaves them in a persistently abnormal state, a state of oxidative stress that unfortunately has with it a loss of function in a cell or tissue-by-tissue basis. So sure, there's adaptive responses, but usually they're short-term. Usually they're sufficient to bring you back to normal. When you're not brought back to normal, you have persistent inflammation and persistent oxidative stress.
Now I want to turn to some specific scientific criticisms of some of the slides you showed and the data you produced. First, your slide 28, which was about some kind of radioactive labeling of the methyl group. We can pull, I think that's the right slide. Is that?
So I have 28 in front of me, and I believe 28, maybe there's a different numbering. My recollection of this criticism had to do with, let's see, I think 28 is numbered on my, I think maybe the next slide, if I can suggest maybe one slide further, that's correct. I believe this result, which 20, depending upon the labeling, I have labeled 28 on my set of slides okay. here. I'm sure that this is what the comment was directed toward. The comment that I'm now going to try to illuminate or respond to was, why would the blue lines in this graph, and what we're looking at here are graphs of the enzyme activity of the enzyme methionine synthase, the B12 and folate-dependent enzyme. So we're measuring its activity, and the blue lines in each case represent the activity when we're giving methyl B12 or methyl cobalamin. And noticeably, the blue line is higher than the red line. And the red line is with hydroxy, non-methylated B12. And so I think the criticism or the question, it was really a question of understanding, why would the blue line be higher if radioactivity incorporation into the methionine was the assay? Because the radioactivity is not present in the methyl group of the B12 here. So the blue line, if you will, has got a non-radioactive carbon or methyl group in it. Why is that activity higher? It's not radioactive. The radioactivity comes from the radioactive carbon group that's in the folate molecule that's a cofactor for this reaction. Well, what the reason that the blue line is higher is because the oxidative conditions in the assay or in the cells, by analogy, turns off the methionine synthase by oxidizing the cobalt. I explained this or reviewed this in my presentation. And when the cobalt is oxidized or turned off, the enzyme stops and has to be restarted, jump-started, like jump-starting your car or something like that, has to be restarted with methyl cobalamin. And the methyl cobalamin, in this case, can come from the methyl B12 that we add. And once you restart the enzyme, it'll turn around and turn over maybe 100 or 1,000 times using radioactive methyl folate to carry out the reaction. However, if you don't have enough methyl B12 to jumpstart it, and in fact the radioactivity, the enzyme stays off, and the radioactivity does not get transferred. So the reason that the methyl B12 blue curves are higher is because it's got the jumpstart material, if you will, available. And as I pointed out, in the cells and in the brain, the availability of that jump-starting methyl B12 depends on glutathione levels. And if you don't have enough of glutathione, you can't jump-start the enzyme as quickly or efficiently. And so in these cells, as with the red lines here, or in the brains where glutathione levels are lower than normal, the enzyme will stay off more than normal. You'll have a methylation defect as a result of that. So oxidative stress translates into impaired methylation. No, so it's a long-winded answer to the question, but it's because the radioactivity reaction is jump-started or reignited, if you will, by the methyl B12, whereas the hydroxy B12, especially when metals are present, is not able to do that.
I think specifically Dr. Johnson said that he couldn't understand how you could measure one of these because you were donating the radioactive labeled methyl group to another protein, and therefore, once it had been transferred, you couldn't measure the protein it came from. What's the response to that?
Well, I hope that he knows the reaction well enough to know that the source of the radioactivity is not a protein. It's the cofactor folate or methyl folate. And so the transfer of the radioactivity ends up being to the homocysteine, which is now converted to methionine by the enzyme. The methionine is not a protein either. It's an amino acid. So basically, if we're looking at this reaction, the radioactivity starts with the cofactor methylfolate, and this is the standard way of measuring this enzyme. Most people measure it the same way. It's written up that way in the literature. So the radioactivity is going from folate to methionine, and it's only intermediately attached to the B12, which carries out the transfer in an intermediate way. So there's no protein-to-protein transfer at all here. And I have to say, sort of bluntly, I'm not sure that Dr. Johnson, in this case, had a clear view of the assay and also a clear view of how the occasional need for methyl B12 would actually make the enzyme work better, which is really why the blue lines are higher than the red ones on a regular basis.
Okay, now another specific criticism was, if I have the right slide number, of your quality control concerning your PCR technique on, mm-hmm. I think, slide 34. Let's see if that's the right slide.
This is what I believe is that we had several slides in which we used PCR to measure the messenger RNA levels of, in our case, methionine synthase in the brains of autistic subjects, post-mortem samples. And we obtained the cDNA already available to us. That is, the way the PCR works is the messenger RNA in the sample is converted in the laboratory to cDNA by a reaction, and that reaction yielding the cDNA, complementary DNA as it's known, is really what you then go ahead to amplify in the PCR reaction. Now, in fact, for the autism studies here, described here, we received the samples from Dr. Persico in Rome, who made the cDNA from the messenger RNA. So that part was already done. We received the cDNA, carried out the PCR reaction for methionine synthase. As a quality control measure, as we did and everybody does, and this wasn't evident in the slide because it's routine, one also amplifies at the same time another messenger RNA that's been converted to cDNA. In this case, we use the so-called gap DH, that is a glyceraldehyde phosphate dehydrogenase, a gap DH. It's called a housekeeping gene that's always on, so its levels can be considered a standard or a control. And then you always express, as we did here, the amount of the methionine synthase as a ratio to this always present gap DH. And so that normalizes to any variations that might occur in the extraction of messenger RNA. And it's the standard way of expressing this data. So this data has indeed been normalized to a standard, as I just mentioned, even though it's not expressed explicitly in the figure here, which was meant to present the comparisons between autistic and non-autistic individuals. And, of course, the difference is significant, as indicated here and indicated in the other slides.
Now, this is still work you have not yet published.
That's right. This is work done relatively recently, and we really anticipate submitting this for publication within the next, I would say, 2 months in order to be practical about it.
In fact, I think you told me you've got two papers that are about to be submitted on your recent work that you described when you were here last week.
That's looking at part of the reason that we have not yet just submitted this as we sort of went along was because the information fits together. And we found ourselves wanting to sort of be more complete in our understanding of these changes in the sulfur metabolism that occur, not only with thimerosal exposure, but it really is a much more global question of showing that the enzyme methionine synthase and methylation in general, in the brain in particular, in neuronal cells in particular, is very much tied to redox status and the glutathione levels. And so as we went along and did that work, we needed to have that rather important, I consider it an important story, complete. There's no sense in going in and giving piecemeal part of the data. And so we needed to have, I guess, in our opinion, a more satisfying story, which only gradually accrued. For example, the uptake, measuring the process of cysteine uptake and showing that that was sensitive to redox and heavy metals, that was a recent work. And then the autism brain studies that I reflected on here just a second ago or described, those are quite recent also, and they certainly reinforce the idea that this work, most of which was done in vitro in cultured cells, does have relevance to the intact brain and even the intact human brain and even the intact human brain in autism. And because of that work being somewhat distinct from the in vitro work, we are now going to divide that into two sections, one dealing more explicitly with the human brain results that we got, and the other focusing more on the in vitro studies and the requirement for methyl B12 in neuronal cells.
Now, while we're talking about brains, Dr. Johnson was also very critical of you for having used a graph that was built on data from a paper, and you did not give the citation for that. Mm-hmm. Can we pull that slide up? This is the one that had duck brain along with other brains.
Yeah, I think he referred to it as duck data or something like that. It was playful. But what it is, of course, was this data was from the literature. This is not my data. Now we can see the citation having been returned to the slide because, in fact, I provided it with this citation, and I never meant otherwise than to indicate that this was data provided, as shown here, but in 1958 by a comparative study, which was actually a table in that paper. When one goes back to that original paper, you'll find this data in the form of a table, and I converted the number simply into the visual image of a bar graph here. And I did, in my original slide, have the citation very clearly, as it's shown here, indicated, because I think it's a very critical finding. What it illustrates, again, and that's not to be sort of confused or otherwise not recognize the importance of this. The importance of this, again, aside from where it came from, is the fact that the human brain status is very noticeably different from not only the other species, but noticeably from all the other tissues in the human that were looked at. And so we can say that, there's something very unique about human brain with regard to its sulfur metabolism. And so that was the point that I tried to make here using this data, again, from the literature.
And in your lectures that you've given prior to your testimony here, was this the version of the slide that you always used?
That is the case. When I first created it, and every time, including last week at Autism One, when I presented this slide again, that citation was very clear.
And the citation disappeared after you gave us your slides.
Somehow it did. Yeah. That's right, but it wasn't by my hand.
Okay. This was slide 17.
That's right.
For the record.
That's right. All right, now you can take that down, Scott. Dr. Roberts had a criticism of you. He said that you cannot reliably assess oxidative stress by measuring MDA, and he said that the T-bars test was unreliable. Do you recall that?
Having read his testimony as well as his expert opinion, I understand what he said. It doesn't have much or actually any relevance to my own work, my own presentation. Raising issues about the definition of the state of oxidative stress, the reliability of one versus another marker, biomarker, because a lot of oxidized products can be measured and will be higher in their amounts during oxidative stress. And one is not perfect, one different than another. And I'm sure in the field of people studying biomarkers that there's controversy about whose is best, which assay is the best. We didn't do any of those. Our focus instead is on measuring the levels of the thiol compounds themselves, not the products that might eventually be oxidized if the thiols are abnormal or if there's too little glutathione. We didn't do that, and so that criticism or that controversy has really no relevance to our work.
Okay. Now, I think Dr. Roberts was the one who also said that you can't detect oxidative stress in the brain by looking at peripheral biomarkers in the blood. What's your response to that?
Well, I wouldn't disagree with that statement. If you want to verify oxidative stress in the brain, you have to look at the brain. There's different implications of that, and one implication I think he was getting at was if Dr. James, in her work, showed evidence of oxidative stress as a lowered ratio of the reduced to oxidized glutathione in the periphery in plasma, does that necessarily mean that it exists in the brain as well? And that it doesn't necessarily mean that. You have to separately measure that. But the fact that the plasma is indicating some very significant signs of oxidative stress at the level of the thiols is creating a very likelihood that the brain will also show that, because the plasma reflects the metabolic state of the liver. When it comes to thiols or sulfur compounds, the liver, the main metabolic organ that we have, is almost in control of plasma levels. And the liver is also the source of the sulfur resources for the brain. That is, the liver releases cysteine, oxidized cysteine or cysteine, and it's that cysteine that crosses the blood-brain barrier, taken up by glial cells, astrocytes, ultimately provides the cysteine to neurons and to the brain in general. So when the plasma levels are showing lower levels of, for example, cysteine, that the liver is not providing enough to keep the plasma level up, you can imagine that the brain is seeing that reduction as well, and that the levels available for the brain are less. So even though you can't confirm that the brain is showing oxidative stress, you can certainly expect that from a lower plasma level. Now, separately, studies of the brain, I mean, I'm thinking here mainly about Dr. Pardo's studies that looked at the brains of autistic individuals, postmortem samples, certainly show the signs of oxidative stress and neuroinflammation directly in that organ in the affected individuals who are the subject of this proceeding here. So there is no doubt that there is oxidative stress and inflammation in the brain, and this would be true also of the mercury-fed monkeys, where the signs of activation of microglia and other signs in the brains of those monkeys showed inflammation in there. So it's a bit of a sort of a bit of a straw man to say, that there's no oxidative stress. How do you know there's no oxidative stress in the brain? It's been measured. It is there. And so these are just sort of the background issues. You would really, they're all in place to confirm that there is inflammation and oxidative stress in the brain.
You actually published your opinions about the relevance of Dr. Pardo's neuroinflammation autopsy studies to your oxidative stress model?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can we pull up his review paper?
Being aware of all these issues for the last several years as our work moved in this direction, I published a peer-reviewed article that was in the journal Neurotoxicology this past I think it was in January that it was actually released. And so this review article shown here, titled How Environmental Genetic Factors Combine to Cause Autism, a Redox Methylation Hypothesis, I attempted in that article to include that a work of Pardo, but others as well, that documents in the literature the presence of neuroinflammation and oxidative stress in autism and in the brain in autism. And
so this is a petitioner's master reference number. My glasses on.
563.
And this journal, by the way, what is this journal, the Journal of Neurotoxicology?
Well, the field of toxicology, there's a subdivision, neurotoxicology, and there's a society of neurotoxicology, and this is the journal that's the sort of flagship journal for that subdivision of toxicology and that society.
Then if we turn to page 6 of this paper...
Mm-hmm.
If you highlight the lower right-hand column from the bold on down, Scott, or blow it up, is this a section of your paper where you discuss oxidative stress in autism?
That's correct.
At the very bottom, you see where it says elevated levels of inflammatory cytokines and evidence of microglial. And then we have to turn the page to page 7. And if you'll blow up the rest of that paragraph, please, Scott. Microglial activation. I guess there's a typo there. The two words microglial activation are repeated. Was observed in postmortem brain sections indicating the presence of neuroinflammation. And then you cite the Vargas paper, which, of course, Dr. Pardo is the senior author of, correct?
Right.
And then you cite the adult monkey studies done by Burbacher and others back in the 90s, correct?
Correct, as well as it's preceded by the other references having to do with the biomarkers of inflammation and oxidative stress.
Okay. Now, Dr. Roberts also said that oxidative stress is the body's normal, healthy, protective system, that we need to have oxidative stress in order to react to insults.
Mm-hmm.
What's your answer to that criticism?
Well, it's not a criticism. I think it's a fair and a correct scientific statement. And I've come to appreciate that. It's a question of the details of how is that how does that play out? Who are the players in this adaptive responses to oxidative stress? And we certainly do that. And it is important. Nature has availed herself, if I could use that, of the importance of this in terms of great deal of complexity in the many different ways that we do respond to stressors, not just of an oxidative nature, but things that impact on us. Ultimately can use that same system as an adaptive system. So, yes, it's very important and it's very complex.
How can oxidative stress then become a hazard to us?
I alluded to this a little earlier. My view of that is that cells, and I don't think I included a slide to that effect, although I have one that I'm mentally thinking of here, that cells normally operate at a normal redox set point that's appropriate for that cell, that function. But oxidative conditions shift the redox set point to a different value, let's say a more oxidized value. And this is what stress does. It could be a foreign intruder, like a bacteria or a splinter or something like that, some event that's a stressor. And so the cells, they adapt to that, and they mobilize their metabolism to offset that stressor and hopefully resolve it. And they do that by shifting gene expression, and methylation is how they do that. They do that by cytokines release that attracts white blood cells. So there's a lot of adaptive responses. And usually those situations resolve because the adaptive responses have been successful in dealing with the stressor source. And then the mechanism is reversed. Methylation returns to normal. The cytokine production goes back down again. And we're back to business as usual in a certain way. And that kind of adaptive mechanism is really very critical. However, the ability to move back again depends on having adequately resolved the oxidative stress that's the trigger for these adaptive responses. If for whatever reason, and xenotoxins or toxic substances that interfere with sulfur metabolism is a primary problem here, if you're not as able to move back again to restore normal function, you remain in this adaptive state, and it becomes a maladaptive state. It gives rise to chronic diseases, chronic conditions, and then there are many of them. Almost any inflammatory condition, an itis kind of disorder, would be an example of a chronic inflammation state. And the failure to resolve that and come back to normal gives chronic diseases. In the case of neurological problems like autism, that's reflected likewise as a loss of function associated with a chronic oxidatively stressed state that reflects an inability to return to normal.
And can inorganic mercury in the brain create such a permanent oxidative stress state?
That's right. The key thing is that it represents a potential stressor, sure, but even more important, in my opinion, is the fact that it defeats or interferes with the system that brings us back again to normal. For the case of, let's say, vaccine-associated thimerosal or mercury exposure, let's say that all individuals experience some response to mercury, the presence of that, but that some are able to deal with it, and they resolve it. Maybe they excrete the mercury, or maybe even if the mercury is still present, they have enough reserve to bring the system back to normal. That is to say, their genes allow them a more effective adaptive response, so they can handle higher levels of mercury, and they may have some consequences, but not long-term and not as severe. And so in those cases, the neurological consequences wouldn't be as great. So in any case, the differences can be individual, and the duration of this and the role of mercury in particular, because it defeats the response system. It's, therefore, it's not only a stressor, but it defeats the ability to recover. I think of this a little bit like AIDS virus, because the AIDS virus interferes with our immune system, the very system that we rely on to deal with foreign invaders. So by inactivating that system, the AIDS virus is going to be persistent because it, in a, we could say, clever manner, has interfered with our ability to deal with that its very presence.
Now, another specific criticism, I think this was from Dr. Mailman, was that in your cellular model, you didn't have copper involved, and that in the body, copper is present and provides some protective mechanism from oxidative stress. Mm-hmm. What's your response to that?
Again, I'll respect the perceptiveness of that comment, because copper is a player in sulfur metabolism and in redox regulation. In our own studies, Wally et al. That we published, we had a series of studies with copper and its oxidized 2-plus or reduced 1-plus states. We showed opposite effects of those two states of copper here. And as it turns out, that copper's a counterbalance to the cysteine in its oxidized and reduced forms, that the two of them are exchangeable. So you can shift the copper to its reduced form, and at the same time you're shifting the cysteine to its oxidized form. The two of them can reciprocally interact. So in any case, copper is an important factor, and I acknowledge that. Now, in our studies, it was not, with the exception of those experiments, a variable, and certainly we didn't necessarily include it, nor did we include zinc or any other important additional factor as a supplement. But the way our experiments and everybody else's are done in cultured cells is you have them in a media, and the media contains basic salts and nutrient materials that are sort of from chemical origin, and then you add in, let's say, 10% fetal bovine serum or fetal calf serum. This is the key ingredient to allow the cells to divide. And that really represents blood in serum and contains all the things that are in blood or serum as it comes along, which includes some sorts of copper as well as everything else that's in there. So our cells see copper routinely as a matter of their exposure to the 10% fetal calf serum. We don't go out of our way to change that. It wasn't the variable that we were looking at. But we do acknowledge that copper does have effects on sulfur metabolism.
Now, there were a couple criticisms of one of your slides where you were measuring the change in glutathione in relation to thimerosal exposure. If we pull that, so I think it's slide 24, if I have the number right. Yes, I believe it was this slide. The first criticism from Dr. Jones was, he said that he had devised at least one test to measure glutathione, and that he couldn't understand how you could measure glutathione at 0.1 nanomolar level. I think he said this several times. What's your response to that criticism?
This was confusing to me. I don't know. I think Dr. Jones, again, was setting up an experimental situation which did not apply to us. He seemed to be saying, well, if you're seeing effects of thimerosal at 10 to the minus 9th or a nanomolar level, now that must mean that you're measuring somehow changes of glutathione in that same concentration range. Again, as if one molecule of thimerosal was interacting with one molecule of glutathione. And that's not what we were measuring. And that's not what happens. Matter of fact, if you look at the y-axis here, the vertical axis, you can see that the amount of 750 is the intercept there per milligram protein goes down from 750, I suppose, to 350, a 300 nanomolar change associated with that 10 to the minus 9th or 1 nanomolar concentration of thimerosal. So that's, even on the face of this graph, a 300 moles per milligram change of the glutathione for 1 nanomole change in the presence of the thimerosal. And so right away, as we have recognized, it tells you that it's not a one-for-one change in the glutathione. So we're not measuring minute changes in glutathione. They're major changes. You're looking at 40% decreases or 50% decreases in the amount of glutathione, way beyond what that molecule of thimerosal could ever do itself. Just not. That's why it points, as I've indicated several times, it points to the fact that it has a big multiplier effect, because it's actually affecting regulatory proteins like thioredoxin or glutaredoxin or thioredoxin reductase that are many times over affecting the glutathione status.
And then I think Dr. Johnson also had a criticism of this particular experiment. And if I understood him correctly, what he was saying is in this particular line of cells, glutathione is not present at the levels that you claim to be detecting. That it's lower.
I heard that comment off of his testimony, and I take it to heart. Actually, I only heard it, quite frankly, last night. I checked myself, also looking in the literature, and I found papers that had actually higher levels, and I found a number of papers that had lower levels than this, and I feel incumbent on me to go back to the lab and to respond to his comments by checking on the calculation that goes into this left-hand axis number. But no matter what that is, there might be, and I allow that possibility, there might be something to look for there. But the effects of thimerosal, no matter what that absolute number is, are obvious. And they're not only obvious here as a 40% decrease from whatever the absolute number was on the left-hand axis, which is important, and I do need to address that. But the decrease that it caused is obvious. Moreover, this measurement of glutathione, as I presented, is only like a middle step or one of the three or four or five different steps in the process that are all showing the same dose-response relationship to thimerosal. So the glutathione levels, per se, are only one of a pattern of activities that reflect the interference with sulfur metabolism of the thimerosal. And I might also add that the glutathione is very easily converted to other things when you stop a reaction. And you'll have the highest levels of glutathione at the time the cells are healthy and normal. And then the way experiments are done, you then stop whatever treatments are taking place, and then you go ahead to measure the glutathione, which takes a certain interval of time. And that interval of time, no doubt, is associated with some loss of the glutathione. Because of its nature, it's unstable. So I take to heart those comments, the higher levels are associated with the most efficient measurement of the true values. They're not going to go up, experimentally speaking. They can only go down. And so the fact that we had higher levels at least puts us on the better side of that relationship.
So even if you have the wrong absolute numbers for glutathione here because of a miscalculation of some kind, the relative change is what's important? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the relative change is important. I'm not acknowledging, because I don't know this to be the case, that this is somehow erroneous. Although, because of this collegial criticism, I understand that I need to go back and check and double-check to make sure that that's the case. And we have checked. It's not like I don't check these things. But nonetheless, whatever that outcome may be, the experiment, the way it was done, still leads to the fact that there's a 40% change or a 50% reduction caused by thimerosal, no matter what the absolute value is ultimately determined to be.
Now, related to that, at least I think it was Dr. Jones said that the you could manipulate, may not be his term, but in your cell culture, you've got the fluid above the cells, and you have a certain number of cells in the dish. And he suggested that by changing the volume of the fluid above the cells or by changing the number of cells, you would affect the concentrations within the cells in sort of an artificial way. What is your response to that criticism?
Well, we did experiments just like everybody else does experiments. In the cultured cell system, typically the cells are grown until they're so-called confluent. That is, there's like a carpet or a single layer of cells at the bottom of the well in a petri dish or something like that. And then you add a solution to it to measure the biochemical things that your experiments are designed to look into. So we didn't do anything unusual here. The volume that you add can be, I guess, varied. It has to be enough to cover the cells. And just to be specific, in our case, we find that you need, in the wells that we do these experiments in, typically you need 600 microliters as a minimum. That's two-thirds of an ml at a minimum, just to keep the cells like wet above them. We use 2 mLs. That's about three times that, just as a standard volume. So in case it's not an extraordinary, we didn't like rig the system or something like that to have this large volume. It's typical that there's a volume above the cells. Now, he made the point that mercury has maybe some special properties. That is to say, it has a high affinity for thiols. Yeah, this is where this whole thing starts from. And so cells that contain thiols will bind the mercury. Now, once the mercury is bound, it's no longer free. And so you have two different states or forms. And the driving force for the movement of anything, mercury included, as an ion across a barrier from one side to another or from the fluid to into the cells is driven by the concentration difference. And as the concentration outside is high, there's a natural tendency to go into the cells because it's zero inside the cells to start with. And now when some gets bound, some more will replace it. So over time, an equilibrium will be established with bound mercury inside of the cell, free mercury inside the cell, free mercury outside the cell. Now, our experiments are done with relatively short time intervals, that is, 1 hour. We're looking at the earliest things that mercury does. We could look at longer times, but what I report here are the first things that mercury does. So we typically have 1 hour of incubation, and then we test what the cells are like after that hour. And I'm sure if we waited longer, we would get to that equilibrium in the end. But we're really still, at the time we're doing these studies, probably still looking at the initial stages of mercury moving from outside to inside. And there's still plenty of mercury outside. He made it sound like there's a vacuum cleaner effect where the cells are sucking up all of the mercury from the fluid around there. And although I don't believe that's true, I think it's a concept that's somehow a convenient criticism. But the amount outside is still going to be outside a high concentration. But the cells have taken up some, and some has been bound. Let me expand just a little further to say the bound is going to be found at the highest affinity sites with the greatest probability. You have binding sites for mercury, some of which are extremely high affinity, and they'll have the first priority. And then you have weaker binding sites that have less priority. And if you're wondering where the mercury ultimately will be, it'll be at equilibrium and long-term in our bodies at those high affinity sites. And those are the targets that I'm referring to when I talk about targets of mercury and regulatory proteins. Those will be where the mercury ends up.
Now, there was a couple criticisms of tables or figures you used from Jill James's papers. In particular, Dr. Jones said, he pointed to a set of genetic variations. I think it was it's in Exhibit 49 is the paper, and it was one of your slides also. Is this
perhaps slide 39 or something?
Yes. Now he, I think that was the right table, wasn't it?
No, I think if he was talking about genetics, it would be the much later
slide. Yeah, actually, this is another one we have to deal with, but let's stay with the genetic one.
I believe it was the second last slide that I had, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, that one.
Okay, is this is the right one now? And what he was pointing to, he said that that some of the changes here showed a protective effect of these genetic markers, as opposed to a risk effect. What's your response to that?
So what we were looking at here are six different genes that have six different polymorphic states. And
this is slide 39. Go ahead.
39 for the record here. So the six genes that are displayed here and their differential occurrence in autistic versus non-autistic subjects, that's what this is about.
Okay, and now the six genes are in the left-hand column?
That's correct, and their abbreviation is in the white box, which is from the paper. They're abbreviated with these short letter abbreviations.
And then each of those genetic genes have different variations themselves?
Right. For each of these, there's more or less two possible states. For example, in the top one, the location of interest could have an A, that is a nucleotide adenosine, or a G, a guanosine. So it's either A or G, and so forth for the others as well. So they're alternative gene states or single nucleotide polymorphisms, that is to say, variants at a single nucleotide, A or G in this case.
And then you have AA, GA, GG. What do those signify?
Right, because we have two copies of each of the genes on two different chromosomes, then you could have the same A on both of them. You could have an A on one, a G on the other. or you could have two G's. And so this would be the possibilities that are displayed here.
And then what do you have that's bolded?
What does she have?
That's this is Jill James's table.
Yes, as it indicates in the small print at the bottom, it says significant and borderline significant differences are in bold type. So this is meant to highlight those that either met the statistical criteria of a p-value less than 0.05, or in particular that their odds ratio, the right-hand column here, did not, or in some cases almost did or did not intersect with 1, which would indicate 1 would be just sort of the normal equal occurrence in autism and controls. If there was a significantly different than 1 odds ratio, that would mean a difference either favoring the autistic population or the non-autistic population.
And if the ratio or if the confidence intervals there in parentheses in the right hand column, if they include the number 1, what does that mean?
Well, that means they don't meet the criteria of significance, with that criteria being an odds ratio of 95%, that is, the chances being less than 1 in 20 of a random occurrence here. So they don't meet the criteria for a significant difference. In some cases, because the way she phrased that, significant and borderline significant. Borderline is a little wishy-washy. It's a little unclear, but that means, well, almost significant, I guess is my take on that. And so she, in this allowed highlighting of things that approached, by some ambiguous definition, significance, but not quite reaching that.
And are there any statistically significant values here in the relevant genes that are below 1?
I see several, actually. The ones that raise this particular issue or were raised have to deal mainly with the last one at the bottom, MTRR, or the methionine synthase reductase. So this gene and its gene product protein is one, as the name implies, that's involved in reducing the methionine, the B12 in the methionine synthase, so the enzyme can be jump-started or reactivated again. And in non-neuronal cells like liver and so forth, this enzyme plays a major role. Our evidence indicates it doesn't play that same role in neuronal cells. But in any case, this one has the odds ratios, as we see, 0.78, 0.69, 0.61, and 0.66. For those, each of them is below 1, and the confidence interval is right next to them. For example, for the 0.78, the confidence interval is 0.61, and it goes up to 1.02. So it just goes above 1.0, and I think this is an example of the borderline significance that was alluded to in that descriptor there. So, but taken together, these suggest, but statistically don't actually reach that criteria, because none of them are actually in their confidence interval exclude 1. They all sort of wander slightly over 1, and as a result, really, they aren't significant. These are all the borderline ones. But nonetheless, because they're all borderline, they suggest that maybe having a particular form here of this enzyme or gene is protective, that the risk may actually be less if you have one of those. And I would attribute that, if I had to speculate about the meaning of that, to the possibility that, for example, in non-neuronal cells like liver, kidney, or wherever, that if you have a certain form of this, then it has a contribution of a protective nature. If I were to take the borderline and forget about that and call it significant, that's the interpretation I would give that.
Now, another criticism based on your use of Jill James' work, I think was on slide 13, if I have the right slide number. Yes, and what I had written down is that Dr. Jones said that on this slide, the change in the cis-methionine was protective.
I'm going to let you maybe restate that because the way I heard
you probably understand the criticism better than I do.
I know what, because I reviewed his testimony and I knew this issue was on the agenda here. I think he was referring to the cystinyl glycine, which is roughly in the middle here, which shows a value here of 39.4 in controls and 38.9 in autistic population. Clearly no difference. And sure, on the right-hand column where the significant differences are portrayed, it stands out 0.78 as something that's not significant. All the others are significant. All the others are below 0.05, indicating that they meet a criteria of statistical significance. And so I forget, was this Dr. Jones that brought this out?
What my notes say.
In any case, clearly, you're looking at you're trying to call attention for some reason to the only one that wasn't different. And so all the other ones are different and extremely different. And so I guess we're going to end up sort of focusing on the one that wasn't different here, which is somewhat diverting, I suppose. But the cystinyl glycine, if I reflect on why that might not be different, I think that's really what the question is. Why does the fact that didn't change, is that a dramatic finding, even though everything else is different? I don't think so. We're talking about the cystinyl glycine is the glutathione that's missing the glutamate. So typically the glutathione is pushed out of certain cells. Let's say in the blood, this might be blood cells. Some of them released glutathione, or maybe the liver released glutathione. And then outside of cells, there are certain peptidases that cut off the glutamate, leaving behind this molecule, which is cystinyl glycine, a dipeptide. And its levels don't change, despite the fact that everything else has changed. I quite frankly don't know what to make of that. It's not a significant issue in my opinion, but it would indicate that this is not critical in autism. The amount of this is not critical in autism, and I'm certainly okay with that, but everything else is abnormal, and I have to say that's really the message here, it doesn't make sense to focus on this one factor.
Now, another specific criticism Dr. Jones made was had to do with a receptor or transporter on the surface of the cell that you talked about called EAAT3, and I think we need to pull your diagram of the cell back up to discuss this. Mm-hmm. Which slide would best illustrate this?
I'm looking myself at slide 18, which I think is reasonable.
Now, if I understood him right, what Dr. Jones was saying is that you focus just on this receptor, but these neuronal cells, neuroblastoma cells, have lots of other receptors that somehow make up for any problem with this one.
In the context of his remarks, yes, he was making a general statement about cells. I don't know that he specifically focused on neuronal cells, but in fact that's where this slide is meant to illustrate that, and we did work with neuronal cells, and so my knowledge here is mostly about neuronal cells, he's incorrect about that, even in studies of mice brains where the particular transporter here was knockout mice that don't have that, there was a major decrease in their glutathione levels, and they suffered neurodegenerative consequences in their neurons. Because in mature neurons, the literature indicates, and that study and our own work supports the idea that the EAAT3 is the major, that is more than half, the major source of cysteine uptake or even cystine uptake, that is oxidized or reduced cysteine. So it is, both in the literature and in explicit experiments, and when we studied this, as I presented that data with thimerosal, we found that when we blocked with specific transport inhibitors of that transporter. When we blocked it, we blocked two-thirds or more. Actually, I'm being modest here, but at least two-thirds of the uptake of cysteine was blocked when you block that transporter. So clearly it is the major source of thiols in the form of cysteine to these neuronal cells. And the literature also indicates that in an intact brain, the same role is present.
So is it fair to say that his statement about other receptors or transport sites would be true of cells outside the brain? It's not true of neurons?
That is true. And for example, astrocytes have a different transporter. The EAAT3 is not the most prominent in astrocytes. They have a form which takes the cysteine and glutamate in opposite directions. So that's a different transporter in astrocytes. Just for example, so there is a whole family of transporters. He's certainly right about that. But when we get down to neurons specifically, the EAAT3 is the major transporter of interest.
Now, I don't remember which of the experts or the other side said this, but you were criticized for even calling your cell model neuronal because it's some kind of specialized tumor cell from outside the brain. Mm-hmm. What's your response to that?
Well, it's not a brain. We don't have a brain in a petri dish. We have a cell line. They arise from tumors. They are major tools in biology. Everybody, many people use these replicating cells as test systems. And they yield important information that can then be further considered or followed up on in other systems, such as primary neural cell culture, for example. But the cells that we work with, the so-called SHSY5Y cells, are derived from a tumor, a neuronal tumor. They can be induced to give full fledged neurons with synapses and like a neural network right in the petri dish. If you treat them correctly, they can do that. Or they can be in a proliferative phase where they multiply more frequently. And they are the most commonly used cell culture model for human neuronal cells. We chose them partly for that reason. So they certainly meet the criteria of being in the field, the standard system to be used. They can be neuronal. They can be dividing. They need to be both dividing and neuronal in order to be useful in a cell culture.
Okay. Now, one of the major criticisms that Dr. Jones had of your work, in fact, I think he described it as just unbelievable or incredible, is the low dose of thimerosal at which you found effects. And what's your response to that criticism?
Well, I was impressed from the very first time that we carried out these kinds of studies myself. And if I look back and say, when was that? That was back just in the year preceding the IOM considerations of the role of mercury in autism, the first paper, the Wally paper, where we did dose response curves that showed subnanomolar effects of thimerosal on phospholipid methylation, that peer-reviewed paper, so forth. I was obviously impressed. As a matter of fact, let me relate the reality of the situation. So as I recall, it was in the summertime, and these experiments were taking place, and I said, my God, look at those effects of thimerosal, and this is the same thimerosal that people are worried about or at least considering as a possible risk factor for autism. And I know that there's a committee out there, the Institute of Medicine, that's interested. I had better contact them with this finding because I was so struck by it. And being in Boston, actually the chair of that committee was actually at Harvard Public Health School, so I was on the phone calling people to let them know about this. So I have to say, I too was struck by the low concentrations that were striking because they brought the potential for toxicity involving this system to a higher level of likelihood than the other studies on other cell types and other endpoints that typically had micromolar inhibitory effects. We were, on the other hand, seeing nanomolar or even subnanomolar inhibitory effects. So I can understand when somebody first sees this data that they're saying, wow, what's this about? It seems, it's number one, striking. And maybe it says to people, oh, I'm not sure whether that's true or not. Likewise, replication and looking, that's why we had to go back and look at all the things that led up to that observation and say, well, why does that happen? Why is it so sensitive? And what is causing it, the case of the methionine synthase, to be turned off? Our first observation was that methylation activity is inhibited at these concentrations. Oh, why is methylation inhibited? Oh, we then went back. Oh, methionine synthase is inhibited. Oh, I see. That's why. Well, why is the methionine synthase? Oh, it must be because the B12 is. Oh, yeah, the B12 is affected. That's because the methyl B12 is not synthesized. Oh, let's measure that. Oh, that's down too. Oh, why is the B12 down? Oh, it's dependent on glutathione. Let's measure the glutathione level is down. Why is the glutathione level down? Because the cysteine uptake that supports that is down as well. So, as I indicated before, this is the sequence of events that we went through, and each one of those, as we worked backwards, showed the same nanomolar sensitivity in this systems. And, of course, it led to then other studies, both that we've done in animals, but now more importantly in human postmortem studies in autistic subjects, to find that indeed this enzyme that shows this nanomolar, subnanomolar sensitivity is disturbed and subnormal in its levels in autistic brains. So this is, again, it was a shock to me, and that's why we followed it. When you see something like that, you need to understand it.
Now, after you testified here, and I think it was 2 weeks ago, Did you find another paper that found effects of inorganic mercury at the levels that Dr. Jones was surprised at?
That's right. Well, we're reading Dr. Jones' testimony, and actually it alerted me to Dr. Jones's work because actually seeing first his expert opinion, I hadn't made the connection with his experimental work. It was mostly just sort of directed at criticisms of my own. And now I realize that I, in fact, knew his work. And, in fact, his studies that showed the effects of mercury and a series of other heavy metals on thioredoxin, the regulatory protein that regulates cysteine oxidation, was work that I had paid attention to. Matter of fact, our lab at a lab meeting discussed his paper and in some detail. And then when I appreciated that in light of his comments, I recognized that the thioredoxin was in fact a potential target of interest here. And I had proposed this here when I explained during my testimony about how mercury has two binding opportunities on each side, especially inorganic mercury, whereas the organic only has one. But once it becomes inorganic mercury, it can grab on to two different cysteines, and the molecules that contain those two cysteines at just the right distance. And that distance is about 4 angstroms. I'll be quite explicit about that. If you look at the structure of molecules, the distance is just enough so if a sulfur was here and a sulfur was there, a mercury could extend both of its bonding arms to bond simultaneously to those two. And so I had proposed, as I thought about the ultimate targets, what they might be like for inorganic mercury, it would be a target that had two cysteines approximately that distance apart. And this, when one looks at the X-ray crystal structure of thioredoxin, one finds cysteine number 32, cysteine number 35 are exactly that distance apart. And in fact, they can accommodate a zinc between them. This is described, but if instead a mercury is between them, the mercury strongly, more strongly bonds and stays there, so that one side breaks, even on the rare occasion when one side breaks and comes away from one cysteine, the other side is still anchoring it there. And so it's just a matter of time until that other one reforms again. So this is a rather permanent, rather long-lasting location for mercury of high affinity. So with that kind of background, the thioredoxin and glutaredoxin, the two sister molecules, they both have a similar orientation. I suggested, and I presented this in different symposia, as targets. And now the a paper came out that I just actually found by PubMed searching, and a paper in which indeed the effects of inorganic mercury applied to that particular thioredoxin were in the same nanomolar range, the exact same nanomolar range, that we found inhibition of this human neuronal cell thiol metabolism in. And this paper...
Let me stop you until... Let's pull the paper up so we all know what we're talking about here. We already discussed this with Dr. Jones. I tried to discuss it with Dr. Jones, but... Mm-hmm. He hadn't had a chance to read it before. He hadn't seen it before, and he declined to answer questions about it. But let me, what exhibit number did you give this, Scott?
Thank you.
Another copy.
7.
Correct. Trial exhibit 7.
Right, trial exhibit 7. So, first, isn't it true that at least 3 of Dr. Jones's own papers are cited in the references of this paper?
That's true, and it reflects a close working relationship, I suppose.
And where is this paper from? Is this from a reputable group?
Of course it is. Both myself and Dr. Jones, Arne Holmgren's work is really exemplary.
And how do the findings in this paper support your own work, your own conclusions?
Well, the role of the thioredoxin is to keep to regulate the oxidation state of thiols, cysteine in particular, in cells, which can be either oxidized, joined together, or separate. And what the thioredoxin does when the thioredoxin is in its reduced form, which is its active form, it's able to come in to oxidize cysteines and reduce them so that they are no longer oxidized, they're reduced. So the thioredoxin is oxidized. As a result, it has to go through a cycle and get ready to do the same job over again. So it takes oxidized cysteines, they're called cysteines, and reduces them. Those cysteines can typically be in proteins where they're holding proteins in a certain shape. You know how my arms are sort of bent like this when they're oxidized, but if they weren't oxidized, my arms would be free to move and the protein would have a different shape. So really what it's doing is affecting the shape of proteins by converting oxidized cysteines to reduced ones. And this is how nature regulates many proteins, thousands of proteins. And so when thioredoxin is not working, that in fact those same thousand of proteins will be more likely to be in their oxidized state rather than their reduced state. And accordingly, their activity will be different. So it's a very powerful enzyme or small enzyme that does that job. In addition, important is, in diagrams that I've used, I have talked about how the oxidized cysteine or cysteine is what's taken up by astrocytes or glial cells, and in the case of astrocytes, they're able to reduce it and convert it to glutathione, which eventually the astrocytes give out to the neurons nearby. Now, if the astrocytes' thioredoxin is not working, the cysteine that they take up is not reduced, and as a result, the astrocytes will suffer problems from not being able to make enough glutathione. And secondarily, the neurons that depend on the astrocytes will suffer from a lack of cysteine and a lack of glutathione. So the thioredoxin is important in several ways. It's important in regulating proteins' shape and therefore activity in many different enzymatic ways, but it's particularly important in supplying the cysteine necessary for glutathione synthesis in astrocytes and in neurons as well. Particular features that render it highly sensitive, as this paper pointed out, and it was quite remarkable to me to see this paper. And by way of background, when I saw Dr. Jones's paper, and we discussed that at our lab, I said, "Oh, thioredoxin looks very important. We should recognize thioredoxin." Let me look into the literature at that point, which is about 6 months ago. I contacted Dr. Holmgren by email, and I said to him, "You think there might be the possibility that mercury could interact with thioredoxin in a potent manner?" I described our work to Dr. Holmgren, and he said, "Oh, you'd be surprised. We've already studied that. We have a paper coming out," but he didn't share that with me. So I knew that in the pipeline there was at some point going to be a paper about mercury and thioredoxin, but it wasn't until a week ago after my testimony here that I was able to see this paper and what he meant by it. I further suggested to Dr. Holmgren, and I haven't heard back from him, that the human neuronal cells, as opposed to the other cells that he might have been working with, might have an even higher sensitivity because of, as I pointed out here, the properties of neuronal cells and of human neuronal cells put them in another echelon of oxidative stress risk. So I supposed, and I'm waiting for him, I understand that he is undertaking further studies with the same cells that we have worked with to further test that, at least the last email that I had from him. So yes, the study was very important to me, and I just, however, became aware of it after my previous testimony. Otherwise, I would have included it.
If we could just quickly look at figure one, Scott, which is on the fourth page of the exhibit. Does this show effects of inorganic mercury at the same nanomolar levels that you have been finding effects?
Yes, in particular, the inorganic mercury in the top part A here is the line sloping downward on the left, which is more potent in this case than the methyl mercury. Again, I would say the inorganic mercury has two arms. The methyl mercury has one arm. They're both able to inhibit here, but the effectiveness of the inorganic mercury is higher, and the concentrations that inhibit they describe as having an IC50 of approximately 10 nanomolar here, meaning that the inhibition is occurring at even sub-nanomolar concentrations. 10 is like the midpoint here.
Okay. Now, you can take that down, Scott. Another critique of your work from Dr. Johnson, not your work. It was a critique of Dr. Hornick's paper. Dr. Johnson showed some pathology slides from her paper on those SJL mice and then compared it to the pathology slides from the UC Davis group. The first author of that paper, I think, was Berman. And he was very critical of the pathology work done by Matty Hornick's group. And I mean, do you have any response to that criticism of her work?
The comment he made, I think, was about the immunohistochemistry staining that I'm not really expert about that. Quite frankly, I looked at the figures in the Mady Hornig's paper. I could see visually myself differences in the ones that I paid attention to most. And for example, in Mady Hornig's study, the one that I did pay attention to most was one where she had the EAAT3. That is, she did an immunohistochemical staining for that very cysteine transporter that we just talked about. Now, unbeknownst to her, it was a cysteine transporter. She considered its other role as a glutamate transporter. And what she found, and what I was convinced visually by the evidence that she presented, was that that was significantly upregulated in the thimerosal treatment group, as if the cell was trying to get more cysteine in response to whatever the thimerosal was doing. Now, I'm not an expert, so I don't have like an experience level to say, well, okay, if I look at her immunohistochemistry compared to other people's in the field in general, to make a quality judgment on all of her figures. And I have to say that I can't do that, but in cases that I looked at, and I did look at all of the figures and so forth, I saw the differences that she referred to in the paper. Immunohistochemistry is a visual kind of thing. It's not a number. And so a lot of this falls into the category of, you could say, the art of doing this. And so it's really a little subjective in terms of, well, was it good work? Was it bad work? Was it a clear result or less clear? And I can't really judge art in that way as well. But the differences were clear enough. Now, we also took on very recently a study of the levels of glutathione in the two strains of mice that Dr. Hornig studied. In fact, she sent us samples, of the SJL mice that were responsive to thimerosal and showed these changes, including the EAAT3, and then the C57 black mice brain samples. And we measured a couple of things, and then we measured the glutathione level, which we found that the vulnerable ones, the thimerosal vulnerable ones, had about 40% lower, and it was very clear, it was just clear, 40% lower levels of glutathione in the ones that she found to be more thimerosal sensitive. And in the same time, we measured the methionine synthase activity with methyl B12 or hydroxy B12. And again, we found that methionine synthase activity was lower by about 40%, consistent with the lower glutathione levels. Those findings made within the last month or 6 weeks, I would have to say, suggest that there are strain differences in glutathione status and in methylation status that make it reasonable that the thimerosal sensitivity might be different between them. But this is different. We didn't measure the immunochemical thing. We didn't do the behavioral studies and so forth. We just showed that the biochemistry is different
now
between those. Now, I have to say also, and I will volunteer this, that the thimerosal treatment at 10 weeks did not affect those values. I just want to be clear. We measured with thimerosal treatment and without. But in fact, they were lower in the SJL. But the thimerosal, they were sort of equally low, and they remain low. Now, what you see at 10 weeks after a much earlier exposure is not clear. There are issues about when we measured it. But I'm just sort of volunteering that we know that there are strain differences in redox between those strains.
Since you testified, have there been any other animal models published that have tried to mimic the thimerosal vaccine doses that would support Dr. Hornig's conclusions?
Mm-hmm. As this, since I testified, which has been, I'm trying to think, 2 weeks or something like that, yes, indeed, another study has come out, and it's just the way things are. There's a lot of interest in this, and a lot of people are taking up the task of studying this. And a paper that came out by Laurent et al. Came to my attention day before yesterday, I believe it was.
Let me get an exhibit number on it before we talk about it. What is our next exhibit number?
Number 11.
Your Honor, I guess you haven't seen a copy of this yet, but I heard this just came out, and I'm looking right at the bottom. It says,
maybe it was out, but just not aware of it. It came to my attention not through PubMed, but through an email.
Yeah. When did you first learn of this paper, that it had been published?
Well, today's Thursday, and I think... I believe it could have been Monday night or Tuesday night. I believe Monday night in particular. Monday night, it was Monday night.
And could you just briefly explain why
I'm going to have to object at this point. I understand I've been going with a lot of latitude on what's rebuttal and what isn't. This isn't rebuttal. This is available. If you wanted to rely on this to pop up Matty Horn's study, you could have done it then. And he specified. And now day 13 of the trial. And you get new evidence that's been out there and it's coming in.
Was it you or Dr. Deeth that just said 2 minutes ago that this was published in the last 2 weeks? I guess you asked him that, and he said...
Oh, no, I became aware of it.
No. The question was that, didn't you ask him... I heard the word published in the last 2 weeks.
Well, when was it published? Let's make... if we can tell.
Well, wait, but you're dodging my question. Didn't you just ask him, has something been published? Didn't you use the word published in the last 2 weeks?
I may have, and if I did, I misspoke.
Oh, okay.
I apologize for that. We're not trying to claim a different date than appears on the paper.
All right. I wouldn't recommend it. You have a response to Mr. Matanosky's?
Well, I tell you what, because this deals with toxicology, we can take this up when we do our rebuttal on toxicology in July.
Not unless Dr. Clark and Dr. Magos talk about it.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Not unless Dr. Clarkson and Dr. Magos talk. What I'll do, Your Honor, is this. I'll reserve my objection. I'll allow the question to go forward with that reserved objection. Dr. Johnson, if he comes back by tomorrow, if he wants to address it, we'll address it and then decide whether or not to withdraw it. So that way you'll have the testimony in front of you.
All right, then go ahead, Mr. Wade.
And let me just say, I think this is an issue that's going to come up again and again because there is so much new science being published as this proceeding goes forward. And from the petitioner's point of view, we believe you should have all the science available, even if it is brand new.
If this were new, I might agree with you, but it's not new.
Well, it's new to us. I mean...
What we're trying to emphasize is that there's been a very grand trial. And you all have had this opportunity to find these things, having them sprung on witnesses or on the court at the last minute. It's not happening.
I'm sorry, we won't just briefly then, Dr. D, explain why you think this paper supports your general your general opinion.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I think it has to be in support of the criticism of Dr. Horney's study, as this was rebutted.
Does it help you to reinforce what you have relied on from Dr. Horney's paper?
I think I should probably frame what I relied on from Dr. Horney's study in the first place, and then this reflects on that. And Dr. Hornig's study, as we recognize, was an attempt to replicate the developmental timing of the delivery of thimerosal and inorganic mercury in hopefully a relevant model system, two strains of mice that had otherwise a background of autoimmune-prone nature to them. So, at the time I provided my expert opinion here, which was before Berman's paper was published. Therefore, I didn't have the countering finding that they had at that time. That paper showed that there were neurological effects as well as effects on EAAT3, which I found particularly connected to my line of research and my line of opinion here. Now, this study, which Dr. Hornig was not aware of. As a matter of fact, when I saw this on Monday night, I sent an email to Dr. Hornig and said, are you aware of this paper? And so as invested as she is in this field, even though the paper apparently was published originally in 2007, it escaped many people's attention. But in any case, this paper shows, as the title describes, toxic effects that were quite striking in a different species. In this case, there weren't two strains of animals, but in this case, the hamsters that they used were of one strain, and they were treated or not treated with thimerosal, and then certain brain endpoints, including size of the brain or the different brain structures, as well as the vitality and neurodegeneration status of different types of neurons in different locations, was found to be affected by thimerosal. And so these were quite striking, indicating that, the developmentally matched delivery of thimerosal in these animals caused neurological damage.
Now, one general criticism that I believe all four, you can take that down, Scott. One general criticism that I think all four of the defense experts made of your work is that you can't extrapolate from in vitro studies to living human beings. What is your response to that?
This is an easy general criticism, but it's strikingly does not apply in this case. And to the contrary, the work that we initiated in vitro, in cultured neuronal cells, again, Wally's paper that came out more or less simultaneous with the IOM hearings, the open hearings, pointed to methionine synthase and to methylation as an event that's exquisitely sensitive to thimerosal in vitro. And that's all it was at that time. And at that time, well, actually, while that paper was in review and in press, I attended a conference at which a clinician, Dr. James Neubrander, described his experience administering methyl B12, methyl cobalamin, to an autistic patient, and the mother's coming back to his office excited after 10 days, 2 weeks later, to say, oh, her son was so much improved that she was just like, in her terms, like a miraculous change. So in any case, Dr. Neubrander related methyl B12 had an effect in autism. And from that time, we took on a study. We had not studied methyl B12 at that time. But from his clinical experience, combined with our in vitro work, we then went back to the in vitro system to say, oh, methionine synthase, methyl B12, what could be special about that? Why would this methyl B12 be any different than regular B12? And that led us successively, as I illustrated before, to understand that neuronal cells have a special methyl B12 requirement, and that needs to be met by glutathione-dependent synthesis of methyl B12, and that redox interferes with that, et cetera, et cetera. So this really is an extraordinary example, looking back on it, of how an initial in vitro finding can be coupled with clinical experience, and a back and forth can occur between clinical experience and the in vitro opportunities to study that, which certainly cannot be studied in humans. And along the way, as it turned out, then Dr. James, Jill James, undertook her studies of sulfur metabolism, and she also found that administration of methyl B12 normalized these metabolites in autistic children. And then more recently, article that's in press finds that their cognitive abilities are improved by methyl B12 and folic acid, folinic acid treatments. So in the interest of finding correct answers to the issue here, these studies converge to show that in vitro data and the results that it can produce are invaluable in understanding the mechanisms that contribute to the in vivo condition, and also to finding treatments that can reverse the in vivo condition. And one couldn't ask for a more satisfying relationship and a more utilitarian role for in vitro studies than that.
Now, you've referred to some unpublished work of Dr. James. Is there a lot of scientific work going on that's headed toward publication as we sit here today that are relevant to the issues these special masters have to decide?
I think that's obvious, well beyond my testimony and even well beyond the area of my personal interest in thiol issues and redox issues. But even in the thiol redox, it represents a hypothesis, and a hypothesis that was introduced now, let's say, 3 to 4 years ago, and that as such, it can be tested, and it is being tested by these individuals that are carrying out research, some of which is clinical, some of which is biochemical. And coupled with the dramatic need to find answers here, when you have at least a reasonable hypothesis to put forth that's concrete enough to be tested, that's an important starting point. And it has attracted a number of researchers. And again, the issue of autism being as important as it is, not only to the public health, but to the families that are involved, certainly it is a driver for a lot of a greatly increasing amount of research efforts and publications at present. And I'm sure that will continue.
And specifically, not just on autism, but on the potential relation of inorganic mercury to autism.
That's exactly correct. Although, I'm trying to think of the Greek analogy where you can come too close to something. Was it Prometheus or something? Or who was it?
That flew too near
the Icarus, that's right, and Daedalus and so forth. It turns out that the issue, being as controversial as it is, and we're gathered here to try to resolve some of that controversy, has in many cases been a barrier, not only a financial barrier for the lack of funding, but for important issues of, will I be tainted by taking on a research into such a controversial area? And this is the reality of doing research. And it's a question that I'm sure different people have pondered. I know this firsthand. And so in any case, I suspect you would see even more research into the mercury connection if it weren't for the fact that this is dangerous territory to some.
Okay, thank you. That's all I have.
Do you have any cross-examination?
I do. I think I might be able to finish it without getting rid of one break.
Do you want to go ahead and try?
Okay.
Why don't we take our morning break at this point?
Then, I guess so.
It's nearly 10:45. Let's go till 11 o'clock.
Thank you.
Thank you.